Hello, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 3rd, 2006, and this is show number 41. I am Bob Hayes, your host. Thank you very much for downloading the show. We got a really big show today, lots of really good stuff coming up. We're going to be starting off with some general sort of MotoGP news, and then a quick report about the Phillip Island tests that happened this past week. And then we have a phone interview with Liam Schubert. Now, Liam's the guy that moved to Spain recently to become a MotoGP mechanic. We've already talked to him once or twice, and it's always interesting. It's always a lot of fun, so we're kind of doing a little catch-up with Liam. And then we're going to finish up with part two of the suspension tech segment, which actually I guess should really be called part 2A. But that's going to be another phone call, this time with Max McAllister of Traction Dynamics. So it's going to be real interesting. But first, a huge thank you to Edward Davies of Lakewood, Illinois, and Joe Palsy of Cleveland, Ohio, both of whom made generous donations to the cause of MotoGP OD. Thanks, guys. I really, really do appreciate it. It's awesome. Helps pay the bills for Skype and bandwidth and everything else. And then another thank you to all the people out there that took the time to do the PodTrack survey this past week. If you haven't taken the survey yet, please consider doing so. There's a link on the MotoGP OD website right there on the left side, big blue button. The survey's a tad boring, but it's pretty quick, so you know, it's just something to get over with. I think I've had about a 5 or 6% response rate is what I kind of figured up, comparing the numbers of completed surveys to the numbers of downloads per episode, which is actually quite good percentage-wise. So, you know, thank you very much for doing that, all the people that have done that already. But I do know that some of you out there that are listening and paying attention have not yet taken the survey, so please get cracking on it. And last but not least, before we get to the good stuff, let's not forget that Steve Jones has rented out one of the trophy suites at Laguna Seca, and he's still got some seats left in it. He hasn't told me they're all gone yet in any case, so you should still have a chance. This looks like a really great way to go to the USGP, so check it out at stevejones.cc/suite. And don't forget to tell him that MotoGP OD sent you. And all right, that's about it for the front matter. Let's get on with the show. Alrighty, we're going to start off with some MotoGP news. The first little news item, and if you're active duty military, listen up. This is from the folks at American Road Racer 2006 calendar. They announced that they will give a free calendar to any U.S. military member that is located on a military base. The calendar must be addressed to a military address such as a base or an FPO or an APO, that kind of thing. You just pay $6 shipping. So send the $6 via PayPal to info@AmericanRoadRacer.com along with a shipping address and a contact email address. One per address to the first 200 addresses. So that's kind of a cool thing. It's a beautiful calendar. And, you know, if you've got an APO address or whatever, why don't you take him up on that? All right, next item on to the interesting MotoGP night news. It seems that Carlos Checa has come to his senses. Yamaha announced this past week that the Tech 3 team will compete in the 2006 season with two riders, Spaniard Carlos Checa and Briton James Ellison. Get this, both on Yamaha M1s fitted with Dunlop tires. Now, you remember that last week there was a question on whether or not Checa would ride on the Dunlops because he's worried that they're going to be uncompetitive, which, you know, I can't imagine where he would have got an idea like that. But in any case, Checa will get his first ride on his shiny new M1 equipped with Dunlops at the test in Qatar February 5th through the 7th. Now, that's pretty cool, but the funny part about the whole story, and I have to admit that I didn't catch this myself, it was posted on the Speed TV forum, but the real funny part about it is the statement that's on Checa's official website at CarlosCheca.com. He announces the deal, and then he goes on about how pleased he is to have the opportunity, blah, 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 thank you very much. And then he says at the end of this, quote, "The most direct and effective way to show my gratitude for the confidence and support of everyone will be to work tirelessly to have a good season." Now, is that a Freudian slip, do you think? Who knows? Whatever. It was kind of entertaining, and thanks very much for noticing that on the boards there. On to the next story. We might have seen the last of the whole sordid Max Biaggi story. Alstari Suzuki has confirmed that their 2006 rider lineup does not include the Bearded Warrior. Supposedly, this is because Max couldn't get the guarantees that he wanted for equal equipment. That's all he asks. Equal machinery. You know, just the same bike as everybody else has. How can I be expected to ride with inferior equipment? I just don't understand it. Oh, God, it's too much. An Italian website, GP1.it, is reporting that Max might ride at Monza in May, presumably as a wild card or some kind of something like that. But we're not going to be seeing Max for that whole season of Superbike, and I don't know, I'm kind of skeptical that he'll even show up at Monza. It's really kind of a shame. I guess for Max, he doesn't want to end his career on a bike that he feels he can't win on. But, you know, this whole giant mess that we've seen for the past couple of months is really no way for his career to end in any case. And, I mean, love him or hate him, the guy can ride. You don't win four 250cc world championships unless you're, you know, really good. He just never managed to pick up a premier class championship. But that didn't mean to say that he didn't have a good career, because, I mean, in the 8 seasons that he rode in the 500cc or MotoGP class, he won 13 races, which makes him the 15th winningest rider of all time. And, I mean, that's ahead of Seti Girmanow, Alex Barros, Carlos Checa, and Loris Caparossi, all of whom started their 500cc careers before Max did. So, like I said, you know, the guy really can ride. He's got a lot of talent. He's just too damn hard to get along with. Okay, most of the MotoGP teams went to lovely Phillip Island in Australia for 3 days of testing this past week. All the Honda teams, both Ducati teams, Kawasaki, and Team Roberts all took part. Suzuki and the Yamaha teams are going to be doing some testing at Qatar next week instead. And then, of course, there's another big test at Sepang where pretty much everybody's going to be showing up the week after that, which is February 14th through the 16th. But for now, we've, you know, got kind of a small test on at Phillip Island, which is a lot of riders' favorite track. It's a beautiful track. In the interest of time, I'm not going to be going into a whole lot of great detail about this for this report, but the short version is that Seti Girmanow and Loris Caparossi on the factory Ducatis set the top two fastest times again, same as last week at Sepang. Girmanow had a best time on Thursday. The last day of the test, he had a 1 minute 30.06 lap time. Caparossi was only 19 one-hundredths of a second behind him. Then Shinny Nakano did a 130.59, and Marco Melandri had the fastest time of all on race tires with a 130.6. Melandri also really put the laps in. On Thursday, he did 133 laps, you know, not even stopping for lunch. That's a lot more than everybody else did. They were doing maybe 90 for the guys that were doing a lot of laps, and some were doing quite a bit less than that. So, you know, 133 laps is a lot of laps. Nicky Hayden crashed late in the afternoon on Thursday, which stopped him from doing a planned race simulation and from trying for a really super fast lap on qualifying rubber. But he still managed to snag the fifth fastest time overall with a 130.9. Casey Stoner put in a 131 on Tuesday. Actually, that was the first day. And then Danny Pedrosa, who doesn't much like Phillip Island, managed to do a 131.1 on Thursday for the seventh fastest time of all those 3 days. But other big news of the test was that Kenny Roberts Jr. did a 131.64 on the spiffy new Honda-powered KR211V on Thursday. Kenny was 7th fastest of the 13th riders that took part in the test on the Tuesday, and then he was 8th fastest on Thursday. Wednesday was a rainy day all day, and Team KR didn't actually put any laps in on Wednesday, probably due to the fact that they only had one bike out there and they didn't want to risk a big crash. But whatever, it looks like Kenny's back, and that's a really good thing. Of course, these are only testing times, and it doesn't mean anything. You know, it's, the race is what counts, blah, blah, blah. But I'll bet you there's a lot of celebrating going on at the Team KR HQ anyway, and I can't say that I blame them, really. It's really cool stuff, and it's nice to see them with a competitive machine. Now if we could just see the WCM machine out there. Speaking of WCM, the official FIM entry list of who is riding for what team lists two riders for WCM. Jeremy McWilliams, making yet another comeback, and newcomer American Jason Perez, who is the AMA Superbike Rookie of the Year. However, both riders say that nothing has been signed yet, and it's not a done deal. So it's just silly season continued, I guess. But, you know, seeing as we don't know, and I don't think that anyone knows, whether or not WCM is going to be using the KTM engines, or if they're going to be sponsored by Bimota, or even if they're going to be competing next year, it's pretty much par for the course. And then one last little tidbit. Valentino Rossi did some Formula One testing with Ferrari, and he actually did pretty well against other drivers. He had the 8th fastest time. I don't know how many were in the field, but he had the 8th fastest time. It put him ahead of some big names in Formula One. Now, he was driving a 2004 spec Ferrari with a V10 engine, and all the other guys had the 2006 type cars that have V8s, you know, smaller V8s. So, do these results mean a lot? Probably not. Now, that V10 was supposedly limited or detuned or something to make it conform to the new rules, which is a special dispensation that would allow low-budget teams to use 2005 cars with V10 engines in the 2006 season. But of course, we really have no idea whether Ferrari did it right or, you know, if they were sandbagging or what. And again, it's all just testing. None of it really matters. So we're going to have to see if the Formula One podcasts have anything to say about all of this. You might remember a few episodes ago, I think it was show number 34, we talked to Liam Schubert. Now, Liam's the guy who went to the Chinese Grand Prix in Shanghai last year and somehow managed to make enough connections with MotoGP teams over there that ended up giving him the confidence to sell all of his stuff and move to Spain and try to get a job with a MotoGP team. He's been over there for a few months, covering a lot of ground, doing a lot of cool stuff, and I managed to catch up with him on the phone for a nice phone conversation the other day, and here's what he had to say. Hey, Liam, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Bob. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, too. Thanks for asking. So I guess in the next couple of weeks, you're going down to Qatar to be working there with the MotoGP tests that are going on down there?
Well, I won't be officially working for the test, but I'll be on the same circuit working for Dan Keen at the Qatar National Cup, which is the national race series of that country. And they subcontract out to Dan Keen Racing Services to prep and run all the vehicles, which are all identical Yamaha R6s.
Oh, cool. Outstanding. That does sound like fun.
Yeah.
And are you wrenching for them, or...?
Yes. The way it's going right now is my first inroad into the MotoGP world was to contact as many teams as I could and see if they had any positions open. And the bite that I got was through Dan Keen Racing Services because one of their key sponsors is Qatar and a low-size circuit. And the reason for this is because they wanted to have a national series on their racetrack so that the riders from Qatar would have a place to compete, and then they could use that as a springboard to go into other national championships. So they hired him to prepare the competition, prepare the bikes, and basically maintain everything. So there are 20 of us that go down there, and each one of us gets a bike and one rider, and we're responsible for fixing the bikes when they crash, assembling all the bodywork, putting all the graphics on, changing tires, you name it. It's a little intense because rather than having a team, you know, it's basically you and your bike. And if you do have a problem, hopefully the guy next to you knows what's going on.
Yeah, really. So this is a rider that's actually from Qatar that you're, you know, mechanicing for?
Yes, all the riders have to be Qatari citizens. And the top three or four are actually pretty quick. They compete occasionally in the Spanish championship. So there are some inroads because Dan Keen also has a Spanish championship team, superbike team. And this year he'll be campaigning with Kawasaki ZX-10s. So he's definitely got his finger into a lot of things.
Cool.
It's very cool because it affords me a different perspective on what it takes to run a GP team. It's not just about having all your eggs in one basket. I mean, he has to do all the racing in Qatar, which is it's six trips total. One in December where they prepare and shake down the bikes and then also test the riders to see if they'll qualify to compete. And then there are five races which run from January through April. So he has to do all of that as well as maintain the GP team. And he decided to also have a Spanish team. And all of this is to help fund the GP team.
So like you say, it's a business, and diversification is an important part of any business. And
absolutely. What's amazing to me is he doesn't have an assistant of any kind.
Really?
I had a lot of contact with him. My last trip to Qatar was approximately 3 weeks ago, and we had dinner together, as well as we had the owner and main writer for Solo Moto, Manuel Pispino, was there, and he also sat in. So between the three of us, I asked a lot of questions on all manner of things, like what are their favorite circuits, what are the tires like, what do they think of the chassis on the Ducati, things like that. And at this point, I think I know enough where I'm not sure I should be talking about any of it.
That's cool. I understand that. And but you have talked about the things you can talk about on the on your ongoing thread that's on the Bay Area Writers Forum, right?
Yes.
And I'll put a link up to that again on the show notes so that people can kind of follow
you.
your Oh yeah, no, it's interesting stuff. It's kind of amazing, you know. It's Liam's wild ride. You know, we're all living vicariously through, you know, you. You're the guy that said hell with it and you know, sold his stuff and moved over there. So you know, I think that's
neat. Well, we'll see how long the ride could last. Definitely, I'll be here through April, and I've gotten enough suggestions from other teams that I should try and compete in the Spanish championship because naturally my Spanish level would improve. By working around Spaniards and traveling through Spain, and that seems to be pretty critical for me. And also will just give me more experience with various four strokes and possibly two strokes, depending on what I could do if I get hired by a Spanish national team. Fortunately, the potential is that if I do well in Qatar, then Dantin will pick me up for the Spanish championship, and hopefully there's enough crossover days or just coincidences where the Spanish team is testing on this circuit at the beginning of the week, and then later in the week there might be a GP race or a World Superbike race. And that's actually the blessing in disguise. I accepted the Qatar job because I knew there was going to be a GP test there on one of the weekends I was there. The first World Superbike race is going to be there at the end of February, so I'll be there for that. And then I'll also be there for the Qatar MotoGP race. So it's a great chance for me to talk and say hi to people that I've seen before and just to let them know that I'm serious and committed and I'm here.
So, you know, what's your schedule like when you're doing something like this?
It was a lot of hard work overall. We flew out of Barcelona on Wednesday afternoon, mid-afternoon. We flew to London, met up with the rest of our group, and then from London we went to Qatar. And it ended up being about 15 hours of travel time, what with delays and stopovers, the stopover in London. So we arrived at 6:30 in the morning and stopped at the hotel, checked our bags in. Everybody grabbed a 10-minute shower, and by 8 o'clock, we were headed towards the circuit for a full day of work.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, some of the days we arrived at the track just after 8 o'clock in the morning, would have a small lunch break, maybe about 40 minutes, and then we were there until almost 5 a.m., at which point we raced back to the hotel, tried to grab a one-hour nap, a shower, and by 7:30 the next morning we had to be up to go to the circuit again. So I don't know if that's indicative of all race teams, because I know there are long hours put in, but a couple days of that really wipes you out.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. That sounds pretty grueling. So, anything else that you're kind of really looking forward to about this whole event here?
I'm really excited that Camel and Suzuki are going to be testing because I know that Suzuki's running the altered motor for this year, and I haven't had a chance to hear it in person. And whenever you read about them saying, oh, the engine sounds different because of this firing order or that firing order, it's difficult to put it into context until you've had enough of a chance to hear them. And then it all becomes crystal clear. Like, oh, I know exactly what just shot by. I know what this is. It's all part of the learning curve, and I'm fortunate enough that I'll be able to hear it. Nothing puts the hair up on your arms than a screaming bike going by.
Yeah.
Oh, another thing I managed to do, I got a chance to go out and see the headquarters for Dantin Racing, which was probably the best part of the trip. It's a two-story building with a large transporter outside for the GP team. And they were redoing the interior with new shelving and tools, and it was kind of nice to walk around the semi. And then on the inside, the building is split up upstairs and downstairs, and the downstairs is basically all the transport boxes for the bikes, and then one giant room for the MotoGP bikes, which I snagged some photos of, and also another room for the Spanish championship bikes. So a variety of Yamahas from R1s to R6s to Kawasaki VX10 that we were upgrading. And I thought I was just going to be on tour and take some pictures, and I ended up helping drop an engine into one of the Yamahas. So it was a little bit of a working vacation, but for me the experience was worth it because you get to see where the operation stems from, and this is where those bikes sleep when they're not, you know, being shipped or at a racetrack. This is where all the maintenance, a lot of the homework gets done for that particular team. And that was also really nice.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like an outstanding opportunity. That's the kind of thing that people, you know, go on. That's what they want to do when they're on vacation. So it sounds like you're definitely having a good time over there.
It was good because I had had a secret plan that if I do make it out here, one thing I was going to try and do was see everybody's headquarters, and I might get a chance to go see the Grissini headquarters in June when I go to see the Mugello round of MotoGP. Since my schedule is so up in the air and I have the work commitment through April, I'm not really free to take anything else, though if something came up, I'd jump on it. But so far, it seems like enough friends and people have come together that I'll be able to go to the Mugello round. I'll definitely be at Jerez, the first race of the year, so I can give you guys a report on that. And I'll probably be at the Catalunya round. I don't know if it conflicts with any of my other scheduling, but for sure, I'll be at a couple races out here. And also potentially Donington Park. Like, everything's up in the air right now, and I'm kind of free-floating, waiting for things to happen. The one thing that I'm disappointed at is I don't think I'll be able to make it to the Turkish round this year. And enough people have told me that that's a beautiful track. Very tricky and surprising and just a really great place to go.
Yeah, that Turkey track is actually one of the ones that it's kind of on my list that I want to go to. So kind of a bummer that you won't be able to go to it. In any case, I think we're running about out of time here, so I do want to say thank you very much for being on the show, Liam. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's real interesting to hear your stories and everything, and I think everybody enjoys it a lot, and hopefully we can do it again real soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, thanks again, Liam. It was fun talking to you, and we're definitely going to be having to do that again after that Qatar World Superbike round. If you, listeners, want to read more about Liam's doings in Spain and see a whole ton of pictures that he's always taken and so forth, check out his thread on the Bay Area Riders Forum. It's called Liam's Wild Ride. It's getting a little long. It's like 46 pages of posts with pictures and all kinds of stuff. But it's interesting and pretty damn funny as well. And there's a lot of chatter going back and forth. It's fun. So it's BayAreaWritersForum.com, all one big old long word. And of course, I'm going to put a direct link to that exact thread on the MotoGPOD site and in the show notes and all of that. So you can just click through to there and read Liam's Wild Ride. Alrighty, I've teased and tormented you enough. Way back in show number 38, I ran a tech segment about suspensions. And I said at the time that it was going to be the first of two parts and that I'd be talking to Max McAllister from Traction Dynamics for that second part. And I planned to run that for show number 39, but one thing after another conspired against me and Max, and we just could not get together for that phone call. Well, earlier this week, we finally managed it, and Max passed down a whole lot of knowledge about suspensions and forks and all kinds of good stuff. The phone call lasted almost 40 minutes, so I'm going to be running it in two parts, and here is part one. I've got Max McAllister from Traction Dynamics on the phone today, and we're going to talk a little bit about suspension, specifically the modern telescopic fork. You'll remember in our last suspension segment, we talked a little bit about the historical types of suspensions that you'd seen in Grand Prix racing and some alternatives that are sort of common. But the one that's in use everywhere today is the telescopic fork. So thank you very much for coming to the show and welcome to MotoGPOD there, Max.
Well, thanks for inviting me and thanks for having me on.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Definitely a good thing. Can you kind of just give us and give our listeners a brief description of the modern telescopic fork? You know, what are we looking at there?
Well, you know, there's been all kinds of concepts over the years, and the one that seems to hold most true and be used most widely, as you've already talked about, is a telescopic fork. And lots of inventors like to bash it, but in the modes of the mousetrap, nobody's really actually done anything better. And while there may be people that claim it's better, and there may be critics that claim that they've come up with this system's better or that system's better, my take on it is very simple. If it was better, it'd be on lots of bikes. And since the only thing bikes come with is telescopic forks, you know, for the most part, save the BMW, then, you know, truthfully, it's obviously the best available under current technology. So telescopic forks have improved a lot over time. You know, early on, they were literally a tube sliding in a leg. They didn't even have like friction, you know, Teflon coated bushings or anything. Like old Chiriani race forks were just, in fact, the good ones had aluminum legs and there was just a chrome tube. There was no guide bushings or anything inside of them. having bushings obviously has tightened up tolerance and massively reduced drag between the two halves of the fork. Then probably the first noteworthy thing that spent a lot of time inside a telescopic fork was what we call a damper rod. And that's basically kind of a little trumpet-shaped device down on the bottom of the fork and has some holes in it. It's a very, very crude form of generating damping. And there are two sets of holes. One set of holes creates compression damping, and then sometimes you'll have a little hole that's used for rebound damping. Well, the trick with a hole is if oil's moving slowly through a hole, you get little or no damping effect whatsoever. And if you move it very quickly, you get an exponential amount of damping, sometimes to the point of hydraulic lock. It can't actually push the oil through the hole. So the way people would tune damper rod forks in the old day, you'd have the bumpy track forks or you'd have the smooth track forks. And what you wanted to say, if you complained your fork felt mushy, well, you'd want smaller holes so that it firmed up and made more damping and felt more firm to your hands. The problem was when the hole gets smaller, the suspension gets worse over bumps. So if you're at the bumpy track, you complain, well, these forks are very harsh and my wheels are chattering and bouncing. So you make the holes bigger to accept more oil when you hit a bump, but then you've inherently made the fork mushier and the bike sloppier. So it was a constant compromise. To improve on that, along came the cartridge. So a cartridge is kind of a crude form of a shock absorber, and it's bolted down in the bottom of the fork, and a rod, what you would call a shock shaft, bolts to the fork cap. The idea behind this was to be able to make more linear damping. The type of damping I was just describing is progressive. A hole makes a progressive damping curve. So if you drew it out on a graph, you'd just make sort of a upward sloping banana there, and that's a progressive damping curve. The cartridge fork hoped to accomplish was more like a 45-degree line, which is linear damping. They wanted more low-speed damping and less high-speed damping. And in this instance, when we talk about low speed and high speed, we're not talking about how fast the motorcycle is moving. We're talking about how fast the fork itself is moving.
Okay. Bigger bumps and smaller bumps and all of that, right?
Sure. So for example, if you're riding along the banks of Daytona at 150 miles an hour, the waves in the pavement, that's low speed damping. But if you drive through a parking lot and run over a 2x4 at 5 miles an hour, that's high speed damping. So it's something that shocks the fork and makes it have to react quickly. That's the difference between low speed and high speed damping.
Yeah.
And for the most part, when we're talking about this, compression damping is really the key to getting everything to work right. We use rebound damping to control the return of the spring. So fork cartridges were very, very, very crude to begin with, and they've improved a lot over time as far as both production tolerances, production quality, and materials. So to the point where most modern sport bikes now come with at least an aluminum cartridge body, and some of the best ones come with aluminum cartridge rods and aluminum bodies, and they're very, very lightweight.
Okay.
The bottom part, the main body of the cartridge is bolted into the bottom of the fork, which makes it unsprung weight.
Interesting.
So if you can make that be aluminum, that's ideal. Steel cartridges weigh several pounds, and aluminum ones will weigh, a pound and a half or so. Considering guys will spend $300 or $400 on titanium rotor bolts to save a few grams, certainly using lighter weight cartridges is a massive improvement plus you get a performance improvement.
Right, and as particularly at MotoGP, where it's almost like cost is no object, and a lot of your racing experience, because you do work with racers, right, and AMA type of racing.
Yeah, truthfully, globally, most racing is super sport based. Probably 95% of bikes around the world are super sport spec bikes, and if a guy wants to race extra classes, he'll race up in a super bike class with a super stock or super sport spec bike. So there's not lots of, unless you get to the real top level, like AMA super bike racing.
Right.
and World Superbike and MotoGP is where you start to see more exotic componentry. And even then, it'll be, you know, like in the AMA, it'll be 10, you know, 5-6 bikes deep, sometimes maybe 10 bikes deep where the really trick parts are at. And after that, it's privateers with super sport legal bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, truthfully, modern production fork, the meat and potatoes of it, is very, very, very good. It's not like the old days. And as a matter of fact, modern stock forks frequently weigh far less than Olin's superbike forks.
Really?
Which would shock a lot of people.
Yeah, kind of surprises me.
But yeah, they're sometimes substantially lighter. So I'm not a big proponent of running out and buying superbike forks anymore. What makes them work good is what's inside of them. So the cartridge is the key inside of this. So having a super high quality component inside the fork, now that the housings are all really good, is possible. So Olin's and, you know, my company, Traction Dynamics, a company in England called K-Tech, are a few of the, you know, companies that offer high-end racing fork cartridge kits that can be fitted inside of a stock production fork to make it be, you know, World Superbike quality.
Hmm. Okay, excellent. So, and that's definitely something to look into. I have checked out the Traction website at traction.com and seen your virtual max and what you're suggesting with what to do to stock forks. That was interesting.
Well, we have actually this year will be our, speaking of which, we're our fork cartridge kit we'll be using in a World Super Sport team called Moto One that's factory backed by Yamaha Europe. So I'll be over in Europe a lot this year doing just what I was talking about, fitting super high quality cartridges into a stock fork for World Super Sport level racing.
Outstanding. That's really cool. So congratulations on that, on getting a job like that or a deal. Back to the sort of technology of forks, what we hear now and what all the bikes in MotoGP and most sport bikes that have any sort of, you know, kind of street cred kind of thing going on, they're using an upside down fork. And if, why did they turn them upside down? Basically, there's a question for you. And what, how does that work?
The real simple reason they turned them upside down is the outcome is rigidity. And a lot of people are confused as to what actually brings about the rigidity. They think, so the turn the fork upside down, you get the bigger end up top and the smaller end down at the bottom, so to speak. And people think that because it's bigger, it's thicker, and that makes it stronger. But it's actually not. The when they turn the fork upside down, they're actually able to run a substantially thinner wall tube. What's adding the rigidity is clamping area. So by having a big fat tube, there's more area for a triple clamp to grip on.
Mm.
So you'll notice on modern sport bikes, and then you'll even see an exaggeration of it when you see super bikes and MotoGP bikes, is the clamps will get really thick vertically, as well as, you know, be holding this large diameter upper fork tube. So by adding clamping, you know, an actual area to the clamp, triple clamp itself, the more that triple clamp can grip on that tube, the better connection the rider is going to have to the contact patch of the tire.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. And now, why is this something that they haven't been doing, you know, all along? Why did they do it the old way, where you had the male, if you will, tube, the smaller tube up top?
You know, that's a good question, and I've never been asked that, and I actually don't have an answer for you. You know, it's some things seem after you see somebody do it the right way, it looks obvious, right?
But, yeah.
But now I can tell you this: there's one drawback to that system, and there's been an on and off love hate relationship with dirt bikes with this over the years. And that's that when you have a conventional fork, meaning upside right, as the bike goes around the track and the tubes bend and flex with all the cornering loads and when you're on the braking force loads, when the tubes flex, they flex right at the base of the lower triple clamp. That's where the leverage is applied. Well, if that fork bends and flexes, the lower fork leg is still free to move all the way up and down its traveled area on the seal surface. If you take an inverted fork and apply that same load, you're now bending the upper tube into a banana. We'll exaggerate here, but when you bend it into a banana now, and the lower tube is straight, it has a hard time moving through it and they'll bind. And supercross racers were complaining that when they landed off jumps, the forks would flex and they would bind and stick because then the lower leg couldn't slide freely through the effectively bent upper leg.
So
it was flexed.
Now, I don't tend to follow supercross and motocross as much as maybe I should. Are they typically using upside right forks then, or did they figure workarounds to this problem?
They went inverted. They figured out they thought it was a problem. They went back to conventional forks for several years, and now they're back to using inverted forks. And I think what they've done is they create more mechanical slop. Dirt bikes have actually a tremendous amount of mechanical slop between the bushings and the tubes. And they've designed special bushings which actually distort as they move through. Effectively, if you take that upper tube and bend it, it goes from being a cylinder to being an oval. And so there's just enough mechanical slop in it that the amount it can deflect, the tube will still be able to, the bushings will still be able to slide through there. Now, one of the things they've done with super bikes in GP forks, like on 150s and 125s, 250s and 500s, and you know now modern 1000s, that's actually trickled all the way down to most modern inverted forks at this point, is to put both bushings into the upper slider tube. Early on, they had one bushing in the upper tube where the seal was, and then they attached another bushing to the lower sliding tube, to the top of it. And so if the tube bent, that was the bushing that had to slide through the bent area, you know, or through the distorted area, we'll call it. Not bent is not, you know, a little bit of exaggeration.
Right.
But through the distorted area. Now, since both bushings are in the upper tube, they tend to remain parallel to each other under normal circumstances, which reduces drag. The bushings are always in line. And since the upper bushing is in the upper part of that fork tube, if the tube distorts, the other tube's already sliding on it, and it's less of an issue than it would be, or than it was, let's say, when they had one bushing on one tube and one on the other. So that used to be one thing that all GP forks had that street bikes didn't, and now almost everything has that system now.
Another example of race tech making it to the street and making everybody's suspension that much better.
Yeah, perfect example of that. It makes it easier, by the way, for fork service, too, because you simply slide. It used to be you had to bang the bushings and things apart, and now you just slip the upper tube off, pop the seal out, pop a new seal in, and reassemble, given that everything's clean and whatnot. So it makes that easier under a pinch to fix things up at the track.
Moving to the rear of the bike briefly, because I haven't, that was one area that I didn't really cover very much at all in that previous suspension segment. One thing we hear about a lot is progressive link rear suspensions. Everybody's gone to a monoshock, and typically these are just as adjustable as front shocks, correct? But what is a progressive link?
Well, you know, that's like one of the most incredibly misunderstood, misnamed, and thrown around whole messes in the motorcycle business. Early on, when manufacturers started using the linkage type suspension systems, they're actually able to create different wheel rate curves, meaning the shock may move at a different rate than the wheel moves at. The spring being part of the shock, they're able to build extra spring pressure in certain areas of the stroke or take some away depending on how it's all laid out. Now, even an old twin shock bike with no linkage whatsoever had a rising rate depending on how the shocks were angled. It's all a question of circles, you know, the paths that the swing arm swings and then the paths that the shocks swing. So you can take shocks and you can, depending on what angle at and where you position them in the stroke of the swing arm, you can make a progressive wheel rate with just two shocks, or you can make it be very linear. There's several modern motorcycles that have no linkage that have very, very linear wheel rates, like the Buell XB9, or there's the new Kawasaki EX650. There's several bikes with no linkage whatsoever that work well that way.
Hmm.
The progressive linkage, what there is a misnomer, but what they're talking about is having the bike build extra spring pressure for each unit that the fork compresses, wheel compresses. So, for instance, if in the first inch of travel of the rear wheel, say the shock moved 5 millimeters, second inch of travel, 5 millimeters, third inch of travel, 5 millimeters, that's linear.
Yeah.
If at the end of it, say in the fourth inch of travel, the shock moves 7 millimeters, and in the fifth inch of travel, the wheel moves 9 millimeters, that's a progressive linkage, okay?
Okay.
Now, people call the linkage it, but the real term is wheel rate. So it's really a progressive wheel rate. But I don't think I'm kind of selling hot water and hell there, because everybody in the world calls it a progressive linkage.
Yeah.
If you plot the linkage ratio out on the curve, it actually appears digressive. On a piece of paper, if you actually do the engineering side of it, a progressive linkage will actually make a digressive looking curve. So the idea, though, when applied to function, is that the further the bike gets pushed down in its stroke, it'll build extra pressure to help keep it off its bottom. And where this was originally intended or put into application was for bikes that rode two up, for when you had a passenger ride with you. The idea was, well, it'll feel relatively plush and comfortable when I ride by myself, but should I happen to put a passenger on, and the bike tends to ride more in the bottom half of its travel, I'll have excess spring pressure to help support my passenger, and the bike will be more safe. Now, everybody in racing talks about trying to get more linear linkages, to buy linear linkages. Truth is, almost every single sport bike I've ever measured in my life has a linear link on it. And that's one of the advantages of a linkage, is that they're able to make it, the wheel rate, be very linear. And if anything, they rise slightly in the last inch of travel, and it's only very slight. So people get carried away, and they'll buy the parts and bolt them on their bike, and they don't know why, but it's something that's misunderstood quite a bit.
Marketing, I guess.
Well, the fork on your motorcycle, people may not realize, and I'm sure they don't realize this, is that popular in sport bikes and MotoGP and super bikes and most commonly sold product to street racers and track days guys and everybody, the whole lot, is a straight rate spring, which means for each unit of compression, it gains a constant amount of pressure. So people think the front end of their bike is linear because they have a straight rate spring. So that their impression is that they should buy some linear linkage for the rear to make it be balanced. The truth is that the column of air, most people know you set the fork by setting the level of the oil in the fork. The column of air that's sitting on top of the oil acts as a second spring inside your front fork.
Mm.
As the fork compresses, it compresses the air, and air is a naturally progressive spring. So since the fork, that's that air spring combined with your mechanical metal spring, they act as a progressive spring. They always have and always will. So it's actually good, and that's supposed to work only in the bottom third of the stroke where you're trying to control bottoming. So it's actually good, in my opinion, to have a slightly rising rate link. That way the bike remains balanced in the mid-turn when there's a tremendous load on the chassis. Because you don't want the attitude of the bike to change mid-turn when the rider's at partial throttle or neutral throttle just due to centripetal force, squashing one end of the bike because it's not balanced.
Alrighty, that was cool. Thanks again, Max. Like I said, part two will be coming next week, I promise. It is ready. I've got it ready. Just having it in here would have made this episode way too long, so you're just going to have to wait. In the meantime, why don't you take a look at the Traction Dynamics website at www.traction.com. That's Traction with two X's, TRAXXION.com. And, of course, I'll put a link on the MotoGPOD website as well. Alrighty, that's going to do it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, like I said, we've got Max McAllister Part 2. We're going to be talking a little bit about the Suzuki and Yamaha testing at Qatar, and we'll have another interview with someone really interesting, I guarantee it. And I guarantee that you're going to like it. but you're just going to have to listen again next week to find out who it is, because it's going to be a surprise. And with luck, there might be a few other changes to MotoGP as well. Hopefully good ones. We'll just have to see. And, oh, one last thing. The Motorcycle Podcast Group is more or less off to a roaring start. I've mentioned it before. It's kind of a loose network of podcasts that includes MotoGP ODE, and then the Road Racer Podcast, V-Twin Journal, and the MotoCast. We've been kind of planning on having some joint roundtable sort of podcasts with all of us weighing in on various motorcycle topics and stuff like that, and it really sounds like a lot of fun. And as soon as an episode of that is ready, I will let you know. I think there might be one going up this weekend. But if you want to check out the webpage for the group, it's motorcyclepodcastgroup.com, all one big giant long word. Check it out. Prubert over at MotoCast called in some favors, and we have a very cool logo, which is pretty much all that's up on the website right now. It's definitely a work in progress, but some stuff will be happening very, very soon. Like I said, do check that site for an episode that combines all four of the podcasts, so four times the fun. This is Bob Hayes saying thanks again for listening, and if you want to send me an email, the address is always motogpod@motogpod.com. I like to hear from the listeners, so, send me a shout-out. And until next Friday, I'll see you later. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and despite the fact that Bob has the audio charisma of a talking fish, the MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGP OD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners.